listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 37th installment in our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR. Today, that demonology of Soviet history, Stalinology.
That's right, Stalinology. I don't know, but I think it's my word, the logos or the study of Stalin in the West, so Stalinology.
Mm.
So I want to talk about the myth. Really, it's part of the myth sequence that we're doing, you know, the myth of the invasion of Poland, the myth of the Soviet, over the Nazi-Soviet alliance instead of pact of non-aggression, those myths. Right. And the myth of Stalin is, of course, this is what I think we should talk about today, particularly because it was yesterday, 9th of May, because of the 9th of May is the victory.
Right, the Soviet Union's victory yeah, over Germany, over Nazi Germany. In other words, the person that they claim is the most like Hitler is actually the only one who actually beat Hitler at war.
Precisely. We depart from that point. Now, I want to start with just an anecdote, one of the most famous, about how Stalin behaved on the day that Hitler invaded the Soviet Union. So I go back to 1956 when Khrushchev, in his, in my opinion, infamous speech to the 20th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in February 1956, most of the myths are really based on Khrushchev's on this speech and Khrushchev's testimony. And apropos of the Barbarossa invasion of the Soviet Union on the 21st of June, it was in the middle of the night, so I don't know if it was 21st or 22nd, I think it was 21st of June 1941, Khrushchev said about how Stalin reacted, and I quote him, Khrushchev said, "After the first severe disaster and defeat at the front, Stalin thought that this was the end. In one of his speeches in those days, he said, Khrushchev says, all that Lenin created, we have lost forever. And after this, according to Khrushchev, Stalin for a long time ceased to do anything whatever, meaning he didn't come to the Kremlin, he was paralyzed, he could, you know, he, for a week nobody saw him, this sort of thing," Khrushchev said in 56. But then historians, for instance, at the University of Edinburgh and elsewhere in Scotland, they looked into Stalin's appointment diaries. And they realized that this quote was disinformation. For example, the diary, and this is just the working, you know, the actual hours are counted for in the diary, shows that Stalin's official working day on the 22nd of June 1941 began at 5:45 a.m., and that would be just an hour, two hours after the invasion, and ended at 4:45 in the afternoon. On June 23rd, when the Soviet so-called dictator was supposed to have suffered from his collapse, he worked for 22 hours and 35 minutes. That's when he gathered Zhukov and all the generals. And then following this exhausting day, his shortest working day was 24 June. That's recorded. And that was 5 hours, but he practically lived in the Kremlin at his office. So this is just an example. Another myth is that the Red Army surrendered immediately upon the onslaught of the Nazi attack. Yeah. And in fact, we have the evidence of the Brest Fortress. They didn't surrender, just drop their arms and surrender en masse. They fought back. That's just another myth. But okay, so now I just want to make a preamble in general about when history becomes dogma. Historical events, history has to be comparative. We have to ask, did anybody else act like Stalin? You know, as I will explain. So the history of the Soviet Union under Stalin leadership is one-sided. So it's become a kind of catechism in the West.
Right.
So, you know, and this dogma has made it possible, this is the vicious thing, to equate Stalin and Hitler, as you mentioned, as both totalitarians, genociders, war criminals.
Yeah.
So the falsification of history, the lumping together of fascism and communism as enemies of humanities, stops us in the progress towards socialism, those of us who are interested. Millions of people in the world consider it a sane alternative to capitalism, but the equation between Hitler and Stalin keeps people subdued, ignorant, and afraid of working for change, so that, you know, they're afraid that the consequences of their actions will be totalitarian fascism, right, or totalitarian communism.
Right.
So the demonization of Stalin is, in effect, the demonization of the people of the Soviet Union, of the Soviet Union itself, of its history, and particularly the demonization of communism.
Right.
The demonization of a person really results into demonization demonization of a whole people. Assad is the Syrian people.
You know, this is interesting, you know, too. I mean, one of the crimes, quote-unquote, that gets bundled into this through Khrushchev, but you know, Khrushchev is really just repeating a lot of the same nonsense that came out of our friend Trotsky back in, you know, the 20s and 30s.
Yes.
And that is the so-called cult of personality. And
yes.
What's interesting is that, you know, and, I mean, in essence, the cult of personality, you identify the nation, the peoples of the nation state itself with one individual. And the ones that were doing that were the enemies of the Soviet Union and not Stalin. Stalin was, you know, dealing with the people and the state as they are. Obviously, as you see how he engaged the people to defend, for example, all the different things that happened in terms of building the economy and all of that. This wasn't, you know, here's Comrade Stalin with a giant hammer building the railroad. This was, you know, the heroic people of this place and that place building their future. So, you know,
that's right.
It was the opposite of that. But here and elsewhere, and in, you know, in the back rooms where you have Trotsky and Khrushchev's then contemporaries, they're the ones that are building Stalin up to be the same or identical with the Soviet state. And then as they impute all of these horrible characteristics to Stalin, they are, of course, doing the same to the Soviet state and to communism.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, you know, Stalin was asked the question of, in the 30s, by a German, was interviewed by a German journalist, and his, who rules in the Soviet Union, implying, are you the ruler or whatever? And he said, Stalin said, in our leading body, the Central Committee of our party, which guides all our Soviet and party organization, there are about 70 members. It has been, and it still is, governed by a whole series of committees, which we know to be true, but you know, did he assume executive powers, all powers during the war? Yeah, so did Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Right.
You know, this is what I mean by comparative study. You can't say Stalin assumed dictatorial, powers and not say, well, but, you know, that was generally true of all the warring parties.
Right.
Also, Stalin moved the population of the Caucasus out of the Caucasus because he feared, this parenthesis, they never say this, because he feared they would collaborate, they were waiting for the Nazis collaborating. Well, you know, what did FDR do with the Japanese?
Really?
American citizens, not just, you know, Japanese visitors in America,
right,
or immigrants, but actually second generation Japanese. What did he do?
Right.
And he removed
them from the West Coast, rounded them up, seized their property, put them in concentration camps. And by the way, okay, America does things better when it's color-coded or based on race. If they can identify you as being of a racial group that's not the one that they, whatever one they made up for themselves, then you get to be major target. But they were also beating up on Italians Germans and others who were enemy nationals here in Putnam County, the next county up the Hudson from where I am in Westchester in New York. They were seizing the houses of people with Italian last names, including one family, it turned out, that weren't Italian at all, but Albanian. Just because their last name ended in a vowel, and they assumed they were Italian. Somebody local wanted the house, and they managed to take it.
Yes, and nearby here, there are actually, what do you call those? Not concentration... Yeah, concentration camp for Italian, but they were Italian prisoners at any rate.
Right. Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, and we should, you know, history teaches us so much. As you pointed out, when the United States means to attack a country, reverse its political system, take advantage of their resources or their industrial riches, what do they do?
Right.
Milosevic, right. They demonized the representative of the country.
Right, Milosevic, Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, Assad, Lumumba, Arbenz, Mossadegh, go all the way back. And all of them, they end up calling them Hitler. And the only one, again, the first one that they tried this on was Stalin. And out of all of them, including the ones doing the finger pointing on this side, the only one who ever whooped Hitler was Stalin, if you're gonna personify it that way.
Yes, this is incredible. I mean, the evidence is... But wait a minute, how could he be... Right. So then there's another historian, Arch Getty, who's not a communist or... Yeah, who's not? It's an American historian, Arch Getty. And he's based his studies of Stalin on the documents that were allowed to be scrutinized after 1989-1991 of the Kremlin.
Right.
And he attempted to correct the falsification of Soviet history, which, as I say, passes dogma in the West.
Right.
And, and he verified against the evidence, like looking at a diary. And so these documents provide contrasting evidence against the catechism that we believe today. So he wrote, the main causal element in what I call... what I say is Stalinologist literature has always been Stalin's personality and culpability. In most accounts in the West, there were no other authoritative actors, no limits on his power, no politics, no discussion of society or social climate, no confusion or indecision. Stalin gave and everyone else received. The actions of others or the environment within which they work were largely irrelevant. Well, are largely irrelevant and important. Right. I'm still quoting Archie Getty. As a result, these accounts came perilously close to falling into the literary genre of fairy tales, complete with an evil and all-powerful sorcerer working against virtuous but powerless victim.
Yeah.
And just one more sentence. Many existing historical treatment of the terror, including some account quite recently, he says, Arch Getty says, followed simple linguistic conventions and structures in order to illustrate their own only point. At this time, Stalin decided to destroy ... See. Now, the danger in this is that we are in a terrible situation. I wanted to talk about... You were going to say something. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, that's right. Because essentially what happens is that, they paint this caricature of like almost an evil automaton whose, primary purpose is to stumble through the world marauding and murdering and jealously seizing whatever little power that there is. They argue... when they present this and present Stalin as another Hitler, that the reason that Stalin was successfully, posed against Hitler and successfully took out Hitler was because he was most like Hitler and it takes one to beat one. Which then leaves the question, well, if that's the case, why is the major center of imperial power in the world vested in Washington and London and Wall Street rather than in some other place like Berlin or Moscow or Beijing or whatever? The logic of their argument doesn't hold sway outside of an individual cell in the construct. But there are these broad ideological strokes that are applied that are internally consistent along every line to it. And those are some of the things that you see. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, not at all. No, but this, the equation between equating Hitler and Stalin has gained momentum, has begun, I would say late 70s and 80s, the kind of revisionism and fabrication of history. And at this point, it serves a very good a purpose, because demonizing Stalin and the Soviet Union then also, fits well with the demonization of Russia. I mean, it has a global agenda that is of turning people away, of distrusting Russia. So, so worse than the fact that these myths are dogma, they have made it possible to equate Stalin and Hitler, to overthrow history. So, where was I? Sorry. Oh, yes, I wanted to give you the example. I wanted to mention an example of this, of what results into this equation between Hitler and Stalin. And that is the Prague Declaration.
Right.
So, yeah, sorry. It has resulted in the go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was saying, right. That's a perfect example. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the Prague Declaration on European Conscience and Communism, also known as the Prague Declaration, was signed on the 3rd of June, 2008. It was initiated by the Czech government and signed by European politicians, historians, among these intellectuals, also the Czech president, Václav Havel,
right,
and a future German president. And they called, the Prague Declaration called for Europe-wide condemnation of and education about the crimes of communism. So, to date, what I find most insulting, given my age and experience, is that the most visible proposal set forth by the Declaration was the adoption of the European Day of Remembrance for Victims of Stalinism and Nazism. It's known as the Black Ribbon Day in some countries. It was adopted by the European Union and the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, as the official International Remembrance Day for victims of totalitarian regimes. This is turning history upside down. This is why it's important to discuss the myth of Stalin. This is a total, you know, what would you call this?
It's fantasy. I mean, you have a condition where Germany militarizes after World War One. You know, you can have whatever conversations you'd like to have about the causes of that, Versailles and all of that, which, by the way, had nothing to do with Stalin or Lenin. Well, the things that were imposed on Germany were not imposed on Germany by the USSR, for certain.
That's right.
So if Germany rose via Hitler or any other mechanism in reaction to Versailles, it was not in reaction to Soviet Union, communism, Marx, Lenin, Stalin, or your Uncle Harry. That had to do with the exploitation of the vanquished by the victors in World War One, and so then Hitler ideologically, as he rises, challenges essentially socialism. He looks at national, a Volk, a people, a nation, people, as a race, as he termed it. As the the central organizing construct, and his argument was that the Bolsheviks and others have it all wrong. The German worker has more in common with the German capitalist than with the Russian worker or other worker, because we're all German. And so this the model that prevails in Germany as it militarizes and criticizes its neighbors and then occupies them and then goes to war against the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union takes the war all the way into its interior and then rolls back and ultimately destroys the German military. And then Europe is occupied by the U.S. on the western side, this basically because they were able to place their troops there. And then out to the same spot, more or less, that Stalin was criticized for signing an agreement with Hitler in the first place in 1939. In other words, okay, well, if we're going to have another war with Germany, let's have it out here on the other side of Poland instead of, you know, here in our downtown in Moscow. And so they occupy, each side occupies, you know, this space. For the Soviet Union, it's a buffer.
Yeah.
And for the United States, it's an occupation of Europe. And
yeah,
and so
for the
Soviet,
foot forward. I mean, it's
right.
A military base.
And you know, these were the former colonial powers. Much of the wealth of the world still lies there. So, and now they've seized it. So on the one hand, it's an acquisition for the United States. And and a wealth generator, and on the other hand, it's just a buffer for the Soviet Union, and so the reconstruction of those countries and the development of the economies there is actually an expense for the Soviet Union.
That's right. That's right. And it's. I just wanted to mention a quotation by Mao. Mao said to Ung of China, but I can't find it. Hold on just a second. On the cult of personality, which you mentioned, which Khrushchev, that was his speech. Stalin was just this person who alone determined, controlled, and did everything
right
in the Soviet Union. So Mao said, Comrade Khrushchev completely negated Stalin at the 20th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And this is the big thing. He failed to consult the fraternal parties of the world, the fraternal Communist Party, in advance of this question of principle, which involves the whole international communist movement,
right,
and afterwards try to impose a fait accompli on them. In other words,
he did exactly what he was accusing.
He
was doing exactly what he was accusing Stalin of having done. Mao was saying, you talk about Stalin thinking that he's the party and acting without consulting the party and acting as a demigod, but in fact, your decision to criticize him, whom we've been working with for decades, your decision to do that was entirely on your own and done exactly the way
authoritarian. He pointed out that, and it affected the whole world communist, want to call it community, whatever you want to call it, but
right,
it's true. And they continue to the attack on communism through this
right
Kind of reverse personality cult,
right,
of this demonization of Stalin.
Yeah.
He, you know, Mao continued, the question of Stalin is one of worldwide importance. He said this in 1961, although there had been communication between the two, Moscow and Peking then, for years. So the question of Stalin is one of worldwide importance, which has had repercussion among all classes in every country, and which is still a subject of much discussion today, with different classes and their political parties and groups taking different views. In other words, Khrushchev split, you know,
right,
the parties.
Right.
It is likely that no final verdict can be reached on this question in the present century, but there is virtual agreement among the majority of the international working class and of revolutionary people who disapprove of the complete negation of Stalin and more cherish his memory well, you know?
Yep.
I don't know what to say about that prediction, but...
Well, look, I mean, look at what happened subsequent. In 1956, you have this so-called secret speech, okay? By 1965, this split is, you know, palpable. You have Yugoslavian Albania, basically, or, you know, calling each other's sons of guns, each as a proxy of either Beijing or Moscow. And, you know, by 1969 or whatever, Henry Kissinger is assembling the deconstruction of the socialist bloc by the so-called Nixon goes to China trip and detente, which ended up with, in 1989, everything that happened in China and the Soviet Union since, the disintegration of both of them, practically speaking. And it's only now that they've come around to a point where they have reasserted their identity against the West and declared a strategic partnership for self-defense and for the maintenance of their own sovereignty and right of self-determination.
So in a way, Mao was right.
Yeah, Mao was right. Yeah. And it took almost 60 years. Actually, it took 60 years from when Khrushchev started doing that to begin, just to begin, to undo that. So we're out of time now. So let's take a look at some more of this next week, because
sure,
I think we could maybe go into some more detail about both Khrushchev's speech and Mao's response, and maybe some of the historical antecedents that we've seen, including our friend Mr. Gorbachev and etc.
Yes, that would be fine with me. Perfect.
All right, very good, Luciana. Thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thank you. The pleasure is all mine. Bye-bye.
That was the 37th edition of our conversation with Professor Luciana Bohn about the history of the USSR, in this particular case discussing what's come to be known as Stalinology.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Donald Trump claims he's the master of the deal, but when it comes to Iran, it is the art of no deal. The reasons the American president withdrew from the nuclear deal range from lies and disinformation to outright political propaganda. Trump claims he has made America safer, a dubious claim. Closer to the truth is probably attempted forced regime change in Iran. Crosstalking the Iran deal, I'm joined by my guest, Mohammed Mirandi in Tehran. He's an associate professor at the University of Tehran. In London, we have Adel Darwish. He is a political commentator and author of the book, The Edge of War. And in Pittsburgh, we have Ruzbeh Alabadi. He is a partner at Global Growth Advisors, international strategic consultancy group based in New York. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules. In effect, that means he can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Mohammed, let me go to you, Tehran, since, you know, Donald Trump's obsession with your country. I watched the live stream on RT of his reasons, if they can be called reasons, for withdrawing from the deal. And as I said in the introduction, it was a mixture of misinformation, disinformation, and outright propaganda. I think an entire documentary series could actually be made on that single speech. So I want to skip ahead. And the question everyone's asking is this just the preamble to a military conflict with Iran? Go ahead, in Tehran.
Yes, it was extraordinary. He even accused Iran of helping Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, where we all know, everyone knows, that the United States and Saudi Arabia, they were the ones behind the establishment of the extremists in Afghanistan and Pakistan, which led to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And in fact, a while back, he actually said that the Iranians and the Russians are fighting ISIS. So apparently his worldview changes very rapidly. But no, I don't think it's really possible for the United States to seriously contemplate any military aggression against Iran, or the notion of regime change, as they say. Because first of all, Iran is a very powerful country. It's a very large country. The country is united, very much thanks to Trump, because now the differences that existed over negotiating with the United States are all over. Everyone agrees that you can't talk to the United States. They're simply unreliable. Those who were opposed to the negotiations are saying we were right. And those who were for the negotiations said, well, we gave it a shot and we showed that they're dishonest. And of course, this began under Obama. He wasn't abiding by the agreement either, but Trump ended it. So the country's united. It's much stronger today than before. It's been dealing with sanctions for a long time now. And since the deal was never really implemented, Iran is still working around sanctions. So it's much better equipped to deal with sanctions than before. Its global position is much better because Trump has isolated himself. And countries like Russia and China know that if Iran grows weak, it's not good for them either because they'll be next. And Iran's regional status is very powerful. Iran has very strong allies across the region, and the Americans have a presence across the region. So they would be very vulnerable if there was any form of conflict.
Okay,
so I don't take that sort of thing
seriously.
Okay,
well, maybe we're not there yet. Adele, let me go to you in London. I'd like to refer you to an op-ed that John Bolton wrote for The Washington Post. It was titled, "The Iran Deal Was Betrayed by Its Own Dismal Record." I mean, it's really quite fascinating reading because it doesn't deal with the deal whatsoever. Everything on the margins. He doesn't, you know, and the whole coverage of it in Western media, particularly on cable TV, never once, maybe I missed something, I don't watch it 24/7, but nobody mentions the IAEA that says that Iran is in compliance. That's not mentioned by Donald Trump either, okay? I mean, this is what I find quite remarkable about it, and I think Mohammed is absolutely right. It's going to get down to a reputational issue here. I mean, if you don't want to deal with the facts and only focus on your prejudices, it's going to be tough dealing with the United States in the future. Later in the program, I want to talk about how Europe is going to deal with it. Go ahead, Adele. I don't know if you read the John Bolton piece, but it's really very interesting fiction. Go ahead.
Well, it's actually, it's not a surprise coming from John Bolton because we know how he actually stands. I remember when there was a crisis between Iran and the Royal Navy in patrolling Shatt al-Arab at the Gulf, where the Iranians took some Marines hostages who were unarmed. And I remember Bolton actually wanted the troops to attack Iran, and the British diplomats were trying to calm him down. So that's his view. But let's go back to the question, actually, would it abolishing or withdrawal from the deal make America safer? I don't think the question is actually about making America safer or not. It's a question of making Trump's position safer within his constituency.
Yeah.
Let's not forget that actually pulling out of the deal was part of his election campaign.
True.
So he still sees the world through this very, very sort of narrow window of his own constituency and his own promises there. Now, you were asking Mohammed about sort of regime change. I don't think that was – I don't think even that is part of a strategy he has. It is question of if it's continued conflict, it will be by proxy. So right. Iran would use Hezbollah and the America would use its own sort of allies, Israel, and so on. But finally, I think what the problem he had was the deal was incomplete because his sort of allies, the Arabs, were not included in the deal, the ballistic missiles and so on. He could have really continued as an appendix to this deal, says, okay, let's just suspend
absolutely.
The deal, but let's continue on that.
No, Rusbe in Pittsburgh, I absolutely agree with Adele. The nuclear deal was an opening. It could have started a process, and I think a lot of us wanted that to be the case where, okay, you can't solve all problems all at once because we know the Middle East is an amazingly complicated place, but that's not what happened here. And I want to make sure our viewers remind them that Iran is following to the letter. I mean, the inspections are very intrusive here. Now, adding on ballistic missiles and everything else, Iran's foreign policy is extremely unreasonable. And that's exactly why they do want to put this on the table, because they know that's never going to happen here. Go ahead in Pittsburgh.
Peter, you're right. And when President Obama tried for almost 700 days to sign this deal, JCPOA, and it was signed by July of 2015, the intention was one thing, to take military option off the table for national security establishment right. in the United States. And they did that right. Why so? Because they knew if they widened the scope of the deal, meaning if they would include other activities like ICBM and others, there would be no deal on the table. Then they could not bring the Chinese, they could not bring the Russians and the Europeans to have consensus. So they knew that was not going to happen. Now, here's what has happened. I agree the chances of military confrontation with Iran hasn't escalated, but it has gone up. How so? Because by putting, if you will, by boxing the United States in the no JCPOA status, the United States is in a way escalating tension in already escalated tensions Middle East that we have right now. We just saw what's happening within Syria between Iran allegedly and also Israelis. So these are problematics. Here's what's happening with President Trump. President Trump, he says he's about America first. And if he's about America first, even if he was looking at the politics of the nuclear deal, Peter, he should have known that any escalation in the nuclear deal or getting out of it will cause the oil prices to go up, despite what the Arabs will say about rising the quotas if Iran gets out of the market. So that's extremely, extremely problematic. So what's going to happen to Trump's constituency for the midterm elections? They're going to see it at the gas stations. So all in all, it was not a good move. It was not a good, policy. And it is by far the biggest slap in the face for American allies, particularly Europeans, more so than TPP and Paris climate agreement.
That's where I want to go, Mohammed. That's, you know, allies here. When you saw Macron and you saw Merkel, and we had Boris Johnson going to the White House with hat in hand, quite humiliating, okay, the allies there. And this is real money for the Europeans, and they actually did enter the Iranian market. The American companies were intimidated, even though the U.S. was still in the deal. This is a very interesting breaking point. I don't think the Europeans have much spine yet, but, I mean, this may help them grow a spine. Go ahead, Mohammed.
Well, I'm skeptical that they will grow a spine, because the way in which they were humiliated in front of Trump and the fact that they tolerated it was extraordinary. I mean, the dandruff flick, I mean, it was really disturbing in a way. But something that was mentioned earlier, I think was very important, and that the Iranians said actually it was Ayatollah Khamenei. 2-3 years ago during the negotiations, he said that if the United States acted in good faith with regards to the negotiations and the nuclear deal and implementing it, then we could begin talking about other issues as well. He said that in a public speech. But what did the United States do? They did the exact opposite. As soon as the nuclear deal was signed, the United States under Obama began to violate it. And under Trump, they continued that. And now Trump says that, no, the Iranians are going to come back to the negotiating table, which is absolutely impossible for two reasons. One is because the issues that want to put on the table, for example, Iran's missile defense, if it wasn't for Iran's missile defense, then the United States would be able to attack Iran. And secondly, Iran's presence in Syria and Iraq, Iran knows that if it pulls out of Syria and Iraq, then the extremists would be able to reemerge again, and then we would have a national security threat. So,
Mohammed, let me jump in
impossible.
Here. Let me
but
go.
In addition to that,
Hang on. Let me go to Adele before we go to the break here. Adele, I had the impression that Trump's speech was written by the Israeli Foreign Ministry. What do you think? 20 seconds before we go to the break.
Well, I think the Israelis have been making this noise since the mid-1990s. It actually happened coincident. I don't think that Trump had this sort of wider strategy to involve others in that. You know, it would be a good idea if he actually consulted the others before he writes a speech.
All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the broken deal with Iran. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Rosemary, let me go back to you in Pittsburgh. Donald Trump claims, and his cronies around him, like Mike Pompeo and John Bolton, you know, that Iran was in violation. The fact of the matter is it's the United States now that is in violation of that internationally signed agreement, and it's not pointed out enough in mainstream media. What is the significance of the fact that Iran will stay in the deal with the other signatories? Because right before we heard noises and whispers that, you know, Iran would pull out of it completely. If it stays in it, it really puts a lot of pressure on the United States that is the odd man out in this. So it's really flipped over. Iran was always the odd guy out. Now it's the U.S., at least when it comes to global opinion. Go ahead in Pittsburgh.
Peter, you're right. Frankly, the United States did that to isolate Iran, but the consequence of it, which also greatly depends on what Iran will do in the coming weeks and coming months. So could potentially, if you will, isolate the United States. Here's what we have to keep in mind. Iran made a sound policy and sound foreign policy, particularly articulated by President Rouhani right after Trump's 2 o'clock White House briefing on Tuesday. He said, we will stay in a deal. We will try to work with the Europeans to see what's going to happen. The supreme leader of Iran, despite his pessimism, also reiterated that point. What does this mean? If Iran stays in the deal, and if Iran does that in the long run, what will happen is it will distance away the Europeans away from Washington. And that's important for Iran. Also, at the same time, let's look at the economic ramifications. The United States was trying to hit Iran in a way by getting out of the deal, but it actually really hit the Europeans. Because if the Europeans even get out of the deal, what will happen? They will get replaced by the Russians and the Chinese, as we're seeing it today on the ground in Tehran.
You know, Mohammed, expand upon that, because, you know, this is a diplomatic opening for Russia and China, something that the neocons that surround Trump is probably probably abhors. But, you know, I get the sense you've lived in the United States before. Do they actually think these things out, the consequences of their actions here? Because I have the impression that the neocons that wrote that speech for him, they probably were laughing up the sleeve that he actually said it. And at the same time, the same people that abhorred Trump during the campaign are still plotting to get rid of him. I mean, it's really, truly amazing. He does their bidding, but he's still going to be undermined by them. It's quite extraordinary. And I want to talk a little bit about Israel as well. Go ahead, Mohammed.
Yes, I think that, first of all, to add on to what was said before, I think Iran has made a smart move. To wait at least a few weeks is putting the focus on the United States. If Iran had withdrawn immediately, then everyone would have said the U.S. and Iran both pulled out. But now the humiliation for the United States is reinforced this way, and there is an opportunity for the Europeans to do something. I'm not optimistic, and I think ultimately it will fall apart, but still, I think that was a smart move by Iran. I think in addition to that, Trump, another serious mistake that Trump made was that he is banking, or he's hoping, that Iran will be forced to come to the table. I explained a couple of reasons before, but what I'd like to add is that the very fact that the United States has violated this agreement and the fact that it has not abided by the agreement is the biggest reason why Iran simply can't negotiate with the United States anymore.
Yeah.
Because the Iranians know that if they appease the United States, they'll do the same thing over and over again. So it's a useless move to sit down and talk with the Americans. So right now, basically what the Americans have done, and I think the problem, going back to what you're asking, the problem is that I think the ideology of American exceptionalism. The Americans think that everyone wants to be with the Americans because we are better than everyone else. So deep down, the Iranians want us. So they don't recognize that if they shut their doors, if the Europeans are unable to stand up to the United States and they want to remain feeble and weak in the eyes of the international community, the doors to Russia and China are open, and the relationship between Iran, Russia, and China will improve. And ironically, since Russia is being demonized by the West and being sanctioned by the West at the same time, and China is increasingly being demonized and punished through tariffs and sanctions, the Americans themselves are pushing these three countries together. And once you do that, it's not easy to reverse that process. Yes, they're bringing them together. And once that these countries grow closer, any country, all countries, once they move closer to each other for a number of years, then it's almost impossible to reverse it.
Yeah. You know, Adele, that's a very good point that Mohammed makes, because, you know, dealing in good faith, I mean, you know, why would the Chinese want to make a grand bargain with the United States, let's say, on trade? Or why would Russia want to come to the table and talk about arms control if the next president can flip the decision of his predecessor? I mean, this is why these kind of agreements are very important. This was through the United Nations. You know, the way it's portrayed in the United States, it's almost as if it was was bilateral, and it wasn't, okay? Adele, what influence did Saudi Arabia and Israel play in this decision? Because they're probably the only two major characters in the world that are happy about this outside of the circle that surround Donald Trump. Go ahead, Adele.
Yeah, I was checking, actually, yesterday after I got an email from you, I was checking the reaction in the region. And it seems to be the United Arab Emirates, the Saudi Arabia, Israel, Egypt, and the whole sort of Gulf camp, that they were making the noises when they were not part of the negotiation that led to that nuclear deal in the first place. I think the Israelis' sort of stance here is coincidental, but it's been a long-term sort of pushing by the Arab side, led by Saudi Arabia, into reopening a deal, because it's only, like yesterday there were some ballistic missiles fired by Houthis from Yemen. They were Iranian-made, intercepted in Saudi Arabia. And I think this is sort of what part the Saudi are unhappy about. Also, the various Arab regimes who have been supporting the so-called rebels in Syria, who are just mainly Islamists, they feel also that the balance has been tipped because of the Russian involvement and because of the Iranian involvement. So it's actually various aspects of it. But again, you see, we seem to be giving the Trump administration more credit in planning some strategies there. It isn't really. Trump is personally appeasing his own constituency. He's fulfilling an election promise. And if he managed to pull the hat, a rabbit out of the hat on Korea, and we have seen how jubilant he is today with the release of the three prisoners from there, and he would say, my tougher stance worked with Korea, why should work with Iran? I mean, so we have to watch what happens with Korea
But Adele, I agree with you, but I think the North Koreans are going to want to make sure the Chinese and the Russians are guarantors to any kind of agreement, because this has got to be worrisome.
Of course,
you know,
yes.
That, you know, one country that doesn't have nuclear weapons, you pull out an agreement, and now you're going to trust a country that does have it. I mean, this is not being very well thought through. Ruzbe, let me go to you in Pittsburgh, because I think it's really important here. We don't know what the Tehran's ultimate decision is going to be. I think we all agree that having a cooling off period, maybe a few weeks, a few months to decide what to do. But let's say, just for example, that they walk away from the agreement as well. And there will no longer be inspections. They'll be able to go and do what they want. And that should be Israel's worst nightmare. But, you know, that's Bibi Netanyahu's world. But what I do worry about, and what I think is so shameful about the U.S. pulling out of this deal, is that it is an assault on non-proliferation of nuclear weapons. Look at the Saudis. Look who's running that shop over there. It's not unlikely, it's not unreasonable that if you don't know what Iran's going to do, you're going to develop your own nuclear weapon. We already have a nuclear Israel. I mean, we could have a regional arms race. That is the last thing the region needs, to be worrying about the proliferation of nuclear weapons across the board. Go ahead, in Pittsburgh.
You're right, Peter. Absolutely. You're right on the money. Here's the problem. This the broader issue. Let's forget about Iran deal. Let's forget about Trump. Let's forget about Israel and Riyadh for a second. This is a failure altogether for disarmament and NPT. The consequence of, or it's probably going to be the one of the most consequential decision that Trump has made, and it's not going to be just felt within the Middle East region, but across the globe. It's going to be extremely problematic. But also, I want to say that I don't want to generalize the Israelis or also the Saudis. We got Netanyahu in Tel Aviv and MBS in Riyadh. So these people seem to be making a lot of noise and at least be happy about the deal falling apart by the United States leaving the deal, at least for the time being. But I think deep down within Israeli national security establishment, as well as within Saudi's national security establishment, they're losing sleep. They're extremely worried. They're not happy about this because this is too much politics, and this politics is going to be destabilizing the region big time. And on the North Koreans are buying time. We don't know what the deal is going to look like. We just have to look at what President Trump will accomplish in Singapore, but we don't know. But the North Koreans have been doing this. This is extremely complex. If they were going to sign the deal, they would have done it in the past 2 decades. They're not going to do that. So they're just buying time, and I think China is quite happy about it.
Okay, well, I think it's really interesting. We have two really unpredictable characters here. We have the North Korean regime and Trump. I mean, that's an interesting mixture. We'll see how it plays out. Actually, I'm more optimistic with every passing day that something's going to be done with North Korea, because I think the Chinese are going to be a guarantor and the Russians will go along with it. And I think, you know, we could make progress there. But, you know, we've seen the past here. Mohammed, I'll give you the last minute here. Kind of reiterate for us, what is the feeling inside of Iran right now? Because we knew that hardliners were always against this now. Is there some kind of a consolidation of how to approach this? Because like you pointed out, the Iran that is of today is much stronger, given all of the pressure from the West, than it was when it even signed the agreement. 40 seconds. Go ahead.
Yes, I think that Trump has brought about a great deal of national unity. I think people recognize that the United States cannot be trusted at all. And that, I think, strengthens the country. In addition, while there will be economic difficulty, I think that the Iranians see that Saudi Arabia is bleeding itself to death in Yemen and with its other policies. And despite the large amount of Israeli propaganda, things are not going well on the border with Syria. The Israelis are now figuring out that their Iron Dome is not working, despite all the things that they're trying to say through the Western media. And they recognize that Iran, Syria, Russia, and their regional allies, Hezbollah, have been able to bring Syria back to stability.
Okay.
And that's something that the Israelis angry about.
We've run out of time, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Tehran, London, and in Pittsburgh. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.